Senator Lindsey Graham says you should consider attacking Iran's oil fields. Is that a consideration?
Well, you know, this president and his national security team and Secretary Pompeo, our nation's chief diplomat, keep many options on the table, particularly when it comes to retaliating against malign behavior and protecting American interests and Americans and our American economy.
That was White House spokeswoman Kellyanne Conway talking to Fox host Bill Hemmer on Sunday about what the Trump administration has described as Iran's direct attack on Saudi Arabia's oil fields. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable of the Reason podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Good morning, colleagues.
Howdy.
Happy hey. Monday.
We are going to talk in a bit about our latest possible forever war, but first, are you looking for other great podcasts? Let me recommend to you a new documentary-style podcast series that takes an in-depth look at the history of the United States Constitution. It's from our most excellent friends and legal scholars over at the Institute for Justice. And if you don't know IJ, go familiarize yourself. They do the Lord's work over there. Podcast is called Bound by Oath. It features interviews with historians, legal experts, and the real people involved in cases, both historic and contemporary. That's Bound by Oath, available wherever great podcasts can be found. All right, Catherine, tale of two tweets about all of this. Saudi Arabia, Iran stuff. President Trump over the weekend wrote, Saudi Arabia oil supply was attacked. There is reason to believe that we know the culprits are locked and loaded, depending on verification, but are waiting to hear from the kingdom as to who they believe was the cause of this attack and under what terms we would proceed. Second tweet comes from Congresswoman / 1% polling Democratic presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard, responding, Trump awaits instructions from his Saudi masters. Having our country act as Saudi Arabia's bitch is not America first. So, question, is that misogynistic?
Yes. Good question to get to the heart of this important matter.
Thank you. No, seriously, are there legitimate U.S. interests at stake here, as Kellyanne Conway posited at the top of this podcast?
So this is the twist for me here is that we might actually wind up in a war for oil in a way that people have been alleging we have been at war for oil for at least my entire adult life, and I think a good bit before that. This idea that there are American interests at stake is predicated largely on two things. First, whether we have the supply of oil that we need to function, and second, our special fraught relationship with Saudi Arabia. And I think that at least the first thing can be answered pretty succinctly by saying that, this is not the 70s. We are not in the same circumstance that we were in when people are sort of already hearkening back to lines for gas and shortages. And I think it's very, very unlikely that we will end up there. We are much less dependent on the manufacturing sector than we were in the 70s and 80s. We have a much higher domestic oil production than we did even 10 years ago. So the idea that we are going to not have oil is wrong. The idea that oil might be more expensive is right, but industry has a way of adapting to increased prices and inputs. As for the second, frankly, I have no idea. I've never understood the United States relationship with Saudi Arabia, and I would love it if my co-podcasters could explain that to me in some way that is intelligible.
Bouncing from that to Nick, it's been clear since at least the glowing orb photo that
I forgot the about
Trump
the orb.
Oh my God! Yeah, that's gonna be the illustration on all of this, obviously. But that the Trump administration clearly preferences Saudi Arabia in kind of a proxy regional war with Iran. Here, I remember being at an off-the-record lunch with Steve Bannon last year, where he was just kind of going on and on about this with great glee and delight about how Turkey's going to be involved and it's all going to be a huge mess in the next 5 to 10 years. Respond to this part of that argument, if you can, Nick, which is that the argument for why we need to be in there and involved in that regional war. If it's not us, it's going to be China, and China will then have more influence on the region, on the flow of oil, and kind of the rules of the international order. What is wrong with that argument, if anything?
China? Yeah. I'm not sure what China is, but I wanted to also point out another Trump tweet, which was plenty of oil.
Think that was going to be the second tweet you cited also. Plenty of oil.
Yeah.
It's such a good tweet. It's so succinct. That's what Twitter's for.
And it's, you know, it can be used in almost like 9 out of 10 situations. You know, plenty of oil.
Even,
you know,
like personal domestic situations.
Can we make French fries? Plenty of oil, you know?
What do you put in your salad?
Yeah.
What? You
know, a little plenty bit of vinegar oil. And plenty of oil. Yeah. One of the things that is deeply, I think the most disturbing aspect of Trump's, you know, kind of discussion of this is that he, in his tweet talking about this, he didn't mention at all the need for authorization from Congress for what would clearly be an act of war that is absolutely not covered by the War Powers Act or anything like that. There is no imminent threat to the United States. And, you know, this is a place where one of the silver linings of a Trump presidency is that he was less bellicose. And I think that's actually been proven out. He's extended and in some ways enlarged the war in Yemen, but mostly he has been more cautious than we would have any reason to believe that Hillary Clinton would have been as president. And he's been less bellicose ultimately than Barack Obama or George Bush was. So, you know, there's that. I mean, the idea that the president would not even discuss, you know, getting buy-in from Congress for any of this is deeply, deeply disturbing, as is the fact I was watching earlier today a clip from Fox and Friends where Chris Coons, a Democratic senator from Delaware, I guess, you know, was talking about, yeah, like if it turns out Iran is behind this, which is, you know, the working theory, that we definitely should be talking about going in and bombing Iran. Which is just like an immense, you know, idiocy on all parts. To go to that question about China, you know what, Matt? It's like if your argument is that we need to have our finger in every pie everywhere in the world because otherwise China would be doing it, it means that we have not advanced at all since a very crude vision of Cold War theory that ultimately wasted an immense amount of resources, but also American and international lives. And we need to really rethink that. Bannon is wrong to say that if we don't support Saudi Arabia and everything they do, China will, and then we lose the region. That's a misreading of what's going on there. And more fundamentally, it's a misreading of what America should be doing in a multipolar, post-Cold War, post-single hegemon world.
I think that's an excellent point. And I would just add on that, I was reading over the weekend an interview that Tyler Cowen did with Samantha Power, whose latest book I just reviewed at Reason. And they have a discussion there about China's kind of more expansionary or aggressive approach in the South China Sea. And the quality and tenor of that discussion, to my mind, and other people may disagree, seems to repeat some of those same mistakes. And we forget that there's a lot of overreach and sinning that happened on the U.S. side of the Cold War because we flooded into every zone worried about other people. Peter, to Nick's point there about congressional approval, which I 1,000% agree with, as does the Joe Walsh and Justin Amash, who all made the same point. At the same time, is not the congressional constitutional duty to declare war kind of a dead letter at this point?
Yes, it is. I mean, it shouldn't
Peter's
be.
Peter's done now.
It shouldn't be. And there are occasionally calls for Congress to retake its constitutional role. But the thing is, leadership in particular, and really the bulk of Congress doesn't want to, or at least they don't want to when their guy is in charge. And often they don't want to even when somebody from the other party is in charge, they don't really want to. They want to kind of talk about wanting to, because that gives them responsibility. And what Congress has done over the last 4 or 5 decades, particularly with regards to foreign policy, but with all sorts of issues, is give up responsibility and give that over to the executive branch, because the bulk of lawmakers in Congress do not have any interest in being the ones who are ultimately responsible for what the government does. And if you can make that the president's job and say, well, we support the president, who amongst Republicans is quite popular, and say our job is to support the president and to advance the president's agenda, then you don't have to take responsibility for wars. You don't have to take responsibility for spending. You don't have to take responsibility for debt. And that makes it easy for a lot of lawmakers to just to keep their jobs and to talk around issues that are inconvenient for them.
The upside of this is that the House of Representatives is controlled by the Democrats. There is a presidential election coming up. War is quite unpopular. Saudi Arabia is quite unpopular. As Catherine was pointing out, we are actually effectively energy independent. So, you know, like if there is a moment when Congress will grow a spine or at least one house of Congress, this is kind of it. There's also a number of Republicans as well as at least one independent in Congress, Justin Amash, who would be dead set against going along with this. This, you know, Peter is absolutely right. Congress, we talk about this constantly because it's so, you know, in our face all the time. Congress has abdicated its constitutional role. No question about it. This may be, you know, a turning point for
so that. I hope so.
If, in fact, Trump tries to push.
I hope so. I would like to see that. But I would say that I am skeptical that it will be a meaningful turning point, because imagine if Hillary Clinton were in office and Democrats controlled the House. There's no way that the House would be doing anything. The House, if they do anything to censure, to sort of to suggest that they oppose, say, a military action in Iran, it will be in part because they oppose military action in Iran, but also largely, maybe even mostly, because they oppose Donald Trump. And it will be a more partisan than principled stand that won't hold if and when a Democrat is in the White House.
Yeah, but that I agree with all of that. But it's, you know, that's the point of countervailing power. And, you know, and this is the great joy of being a libertarian and not being stuck in one or the other tribe. We get to benefit from the outcomes of clashes between ideological parties that are seeking the rankest form of immediate partisan benefits. But you know what? It'll be a better outcome if, in fact, the at least one House of Congress pushes back against Trump, if he makes a decision to go after this, in the same way it would have been great to have seen actual pushback against Obama when he entered Libya without any form of congressional authorization.
In fact, there was pushback against Obama after doing that Congress. I don't know the exact mechanism, but it was sort of a formal censure and saying, hey, look, you know, you're violating the War Powers Act. You could declare your emergency within the first, I think, 60 days, 90 maybe, but I think it's 60. But after that, you need to come to us directly. And the Obama administration used the marvelous euphemism ongoing kinetic exercise, as opposed to actual warfare. It's different. It's because kinetic, you know, it's different than war, even though we're warring on them.
Most exercise is kinetic.
Yeah, speak for yourself.
What about planking, Peter? What about planking?
I said most.
Excellent point. Excellent point. Catherine, President Trump this morning seemed to indicate strongly that a previous shoot down of a U.S. drone was conducted by Iran, despite Iranian denials there. Is that, how do you pronounce casus or casus belli, Cassius Clay? Is that Cassius Clay to send the a bomb of our own somewhere?
You know, this is always like, there's this idea that there is some kind of objective standard, right? There's this idea that, okay, well, you know, somewhere, sometime in the, you know, in the formation of the nation state, some official rules were encoded wherein war is either justified or unjustified. And of course, that's not true. And so there may or may not have been acts of aggression. There may or may not be acts of aggression every single day. These things are purposely done in such a way that they are often opaque so that both sides have plausible deniability, because nobody actually really, really wants to have a war, right? Like, they sometimes feel like they must. And so that is why we have wars. But nobody's like, woo, let's have a war, unless they are literally insane, which some world leaders are, and occasionally some mustachioed advisors to world leaders are. But for the most part, even John Bolton would prefer for us not to be at war, I suspect. I want to give him that benefit of the doubt.
Wow.
And so, you know, nothing is casus belli unless you want it to be. And that is the unfortunate truth of realism, I guess. And certainly it's extremely true in this case. There will be a bunch of small things that may or may not add up to war, and it will actually be at the discretion of world leaders, unfortunately not at the discretion of Congress at this point, whether or not we engage in war. And it is silly to pretend that at some point a red line is crossed and then the U.S. has no choice or then Iran has no choice. That's not how it is. That's never how it is.
And it's worth pointing out that we almost attacked Iran earlier this summer. We came, according to President Trump, within about 10 minutes of allowing an attack to go through. And he had planned it all day and had given it the go-ahead and then suddenly pulled back and gave it a thumbs down when he realized, this is his story, when he realized that it could cause up to 150 fatalities. This was after Iran apparently attacked, shot down, I believe, a U.S. military drone in June. And it was Trump who pulled back, Trump who had been pushed by his advisors into doing this, into, you know, sort of setting up the attack and putting it on the road to being real. And so, you know, we talk about Congress should be restraining Trump. What's actually interesting is that in the Trump administration, the president has been the person who has restrained himself, has restrained the administration, has restrained the military from acting in ways that I think this is Trump's best quality, is that he genuinely does not seem to actually want to go to war. He likes bellicose talk and tweets. He likes to sort of brag about America's military. He wants to spend way too much on the Department of Defense. But he does not appear to have the let's go to war over every little slight instinct that virtually all presidents since World War II have had.
Although I would add that after he fired John Bolton last week, and or Bolton resigned, whatever, he made some comment, I believe, again on Twitter, saying that Bolton wasn't strong enough against Venezuela and
right.
Cuba.
He's right. More hawkish than Bolton.
Right. So he claims to be more hawkish on Venezuela, which is insane. And there certainly have been reports and rumors over the last year or so that the Trump administration, driven by President Trump, wants to have at least a military standoff, maybe not an actual conflict, but at least a standoff and maybe a conflict with Venezuela. And that's crazy. And that's the sort of nutty thing that you get from a guy like President Trump. On the other hand, what I said was Trump really likes the sort of the language of war. He likes military rhetoric, martial rhetoric. He likes to threaten to use America's military because America's military is big and awesome. And that's in a way that appeals to someone like Donald Trump. But given the opportunity to actually send bombs, to send troops, he has been pretty wary and this is pretty reticent. And this is a thing that has been fairly consistent with him, certainly more so than any president in my lifetime and more so than pretty much any other Republican contender that he was against in 2015, 2016. Probably more so than Hillary Clinton.
Speaking of both Democrats and reticence, arguably about the only bright spot of last week's presidential debate in Houston of 10 leading contenders for that particular throne was kind of a discussion of Afghanistan in particular and what should be done there. And there was a surprising to me amount of support there for restoring congressional authorization for war. Haven't heard a lot of talk like that in a while. Pete Buttigieg was talking about sunsetting authorizations after 3 years, and a lot of people were talking about getting the troops the hell home out of Afghanistan. Catherine, is there a reason to expect any optimism that Democrats have had more of a change of heart on this particular topic?
I don't think that I have any optimism at all on the procedural point. Well, maybe in general, but more narrowly on the procedural point, the idea that the Democrats, should they win the White House, will restore the balance of power by returning some more powers to Congress strikes me as absolutely laughable and wildly unlikely to occur. I do think, though, that it's fairly likely if Democrats take the White House that we will see a drawdown from Afghanistan. Of course, we're maybe sort of seeing a drawdown from Afghanistan now. It's a sort of weird bipartisan, transpartisan, nonpartisan thing that's just drifting around inside our politics like a plastic bag in the wind. No one has idea what's going on. So you're welcome for that. For that metaphor, a little bit of American beauty for your day. So, yeah, I think I do believe, you know, I believe Pete Buttigieg when he looks in the camera and says, forever war is bad. Endless war is bad.
You just like him.
I like him. I mean, I like him less than I do when he first emerged, because he sort of was like, guys, don't worry, I'm going to tell you a bunch of substance really soon. And I was like, that dude seems smart. He's probably going to deliver on that. And then he didn't. But, you know, I do believe that the anti-war sentiment on that stage was sincere. With regard to Afghanistan, I do believe that many of the Democrats on that stage are more likely to draw down than Donald Trump has been, despite his occasional rhetorical promises to do so. But I absolutely do not believe that under any of the administrations of the people on that stage that they will defer to Congress about the declaration of war.
I started this by saying I was one of the only highlights here. I will yield the floor to anyone who can mention any other policy-related highlight that they heard at the Democratic debate. Anyone care to volunteer one?
I mean, there was a somewhat interesting discussion of Medicare for All and how are you going to pay for it in the first 40 minutes or so. Joe Biden actually seems to have studied up a little bit on his plan versus Bernie's plan, and made, like, I think,
you really
Joe Biden's best case, which is not necessarily to say the greatest case, but the best case that Joe Biden has made so far against the impossibility of raising taxes enough to finance the $32 trillion or so that would be necessary to fully pay for Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan.
I know that the way these plans get written isn't that the candidates themselves originate the ideas. And yet there's always something depressing to me about the idea that these dudes have to, like, swat up before the debate to be ready to talk about the thing they would do.
So it's also that he had to swat up to be ready to talk about, to criticize effectively the thing that Bernie Sanders wants to do.
Yeah.
And Biden had made some attempts to say, well, this goes too far, it's too expensive in the past. But he, I think, did the best job that I have seen him do. Again, this is a qualified praise of talking about the kind of just the practical impossibility of getting Bernie Sanders' plan implemented. And he said, I mean, he actually started his criticism of Bernie Sanders' plan with something that I thought was kind of interesting, which was that he said, well, my plan costs $750 billion over 10 years. That's a lot of money. It is. He's right.
You're just happy he said those words.
It's like, it, relative to all of the Sanders plan, it's a tiny amount of money. But $750 billion over a decade is a huge amount of money. And Biden actually seems to recognize that and seems to be aware of the kind of political and economic limits that would face any healthcare reform.
Here's how unlimited the general notion of spending is. I attract a lot of comment, but Kamala Harris at some point just sort of casually threw off that she plans to give $2 trillion to really twice as much as the 10-year price tag on Obamacare initially to historically black colleges and universities just for that. Go ahead, Catherine.
Yeah, I was actually going to say an education highlight as well, which is Cory Booker, who has gone back and forth a little bit on his record on charter schools and school choice in general, saying, yeah, we closed poor performing charter schools, but dag nabbit, we expanded high performing charter schools.
And did he say dag nabbit?
He literally said dag nabbit.
Sure he
actually
that.
Said that. He said it twice because he also referred
twice,
to
yeah.
losing out to the March of the Dag Nab Penguins when nominated for or when the documentary about his efforts was nominated for a
award. That's not okay.
It's
not an okay.
Better
usage.
Than okay. I want to fight you on this. The use of dag nab by, like, one of the youngest people on the stage was really a delight to me. And I think actually a pleasing contrast. So y'all know, listeners to this podcast know, but especially my recent colleagues know that I like colorful language. And I have been deeply annoyed by Beto O'Rourke's plan to prove his seriousness by just saying fuck a lot. And it's because I think he's robbing the rest of us of the chance to use that word when we really mean it.
Against him.
Against his gun policies. He also said, hell yes, he's going to take our AR-15s and our AK-47s. You know, now we have Tulsi saying that we're not Saudi Arabia's bitch. Like, I guess this is just a thing where if you don't have a lot to lose, you might as well try to win by being a straight talker. I'm surprised to find myself in the category of saying, you know what, maybe people who literally want to be president could just scale back the language a smidge while formally on the debate stage or on CNN. And so I appreciate the dagnabbit.
Did Catherine just become a Becky?
I know. I don't know what happened, but I understand when you're president, you need to sometimes drop F-bombs and sometimes drop actual bombs, but I guess I would prefer that they do so only rarely and judiciously.
Nick, did you see anything that was positive that hasn't been mentioned so far and worthy of comment?
Andrew Yang had a nice riff about the historical role of immigration and of the United States as a magnet for immigrants as a positive force, which I thought was nice to hear. But overall, you know, it from a libertarian perspective, it was a deeply disturbing showing because first off, you know, it's becoming increasingly clear that the race at this point is really between Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Joe Biden, and none of them, you know, from a libertarian perspective, has much to offer. I mean, they all in various ways want to either maintain the exact status quo or much more, you know, common, they want to expand it substantially, you know, and that's neither of that is good. But like there just is not apart from not even so much policies as a couple of phrases that were popular. There was very little on the stage that would, I think, entice anybody who's interested in restricting the size, scope, and spending of government and empowering individuals in a big and distinct and ongoing
but
way.
But isn't that what's even more depressing is that this stage and the rhetoric that we heard from it really suggests that there is a limited audience for restricting the size, scope, and power of the federal government.
Among Democrats, for sure. You know, the other thing that is also kind of interesting when we think about it in those terms, because, you know, the question isn't, you know, how bad are the Democrats? It's, you know, it's that plus how bad is Trump and which one's going to be better. When trade came up, you know, if you listen closely, very few people on that stage, if anyone, was actually saying, you know, we should have a trade policy that is much more about free trade, regardless of what other countries are doing. Most of them, in fact, said, you know, Trump essentially is correct in doing what he's doing. You know, and there's every reason, certainly from Warren and Sanders, and to a certain degree, Biden, because he was not a free trade Democrat in the way that, say, Bill Clinton was at a certain point. So without going full libertarian and saying, you know, there's really not a dime's worth of difference between Trump and any of the Democratic candidates, we're starting to get closer to that kind of awakening.
I mean, both Buttigieg and Beto O'Rourke have on the trail, and I think Klobuchar, too, have on the trail. And now, actually, Klobuchar's been awful on trade, but have mentioned this. But it is telling. I mean, these theaters, I think, in some ways matter more than people who criticize political theater say, in the sense of when they show that timidity, when the basic critique of Donald Trump's trade policy is that, oh, he's just being erratic. Like, you know, Bernie Sanders said something like, well, the first problem is that he doesn't understand trade. And then after, I don't know why he turned into Alex Jones there, but that's apropos of something. Mm. But in fact, Bernie Sanders has been against every single trade treaty of the last 70 years and thinks that it's all a race to the bottom in terms of both wages and environmental standards. And this is so profoundly wrong. This is a prejudice that is anchored in such little empirical anything, and yet is still a large part of the Democratic coalition is deeply distressing. Catherine, did I hear you trying to interrupt me?
No, I would never interrupt you, Matt.
Thank you for saying that. Last round, any one big takeaway from the Democratic debate could be anything that you want. Catherine, you go first.
Kierkegaard. That's my big takeaway. So I hadn't realized that Joe Biden has been trotting out the Kierkegaard quote for quite a long time. When I went Googling, I discovered that there's a whole story about Jill Biden taping this quote about faith.
Dr. Jill Biden
taping this quote about faith seeing best in the dark to a mirror. But I was actually out of town for the debate. So I was like in that weird, like liminal space of just like watching TV in my hotel room all by my lonesome. And at the end of the debate, I just was like Googling Kierkegaard quotes, which was just really, it felt really right, you
guys. Which is how most of your nights end.
How most of my nights end when I'm out of town. And I just was like tweeting various Kierkegaard quotes and attributing them to Joe Biden. And quite a few people on Twitter just assumed they were things Joe Biden had really said including anxiety is the dizziness of freedom. So just like imagine, if you will, a world where Kierkegaard is just like on the debate stage and no one notices the difference.
Yeah, I don't know when exactly Catherine stroked out, but I'm kind of liking it. Peter, any other takeaway from the Democratic debate?
Joe Biden likes record players.
Yeah. Oh, my God. The word salad.
I'm disappointed he didn't say Victrola. That would have. I think that would have pushed him over
the
top.
You have to put the record player on to help the children learn.
Yeah. Also, isn't that, I actually meant to look this up. I think he got that study exactly backward. Like, I'm pretty sure that what that study said, at least as I recall it from when it was in currency, when people were talking about it a lot, like 10 or 15 years ago, was that the thing that gives, you know, upper class children advantages is that they hear a wide variety and a large volume of spoken words from their parents and the adults around them. That helps form their brains, et cetera, et cetera. I'm pretty sure the finding does not show that having the TV on produces the same effect. And while I can't speak to the difference between a record player or a television, since I don't think this study focused on record players, my belief is that actually putting the record player on in the evening would do the exact opposite of the thing that study encouraged, and also that that study has somewhat fallen out of favor among education theorists who have moved on to other explanations for why rich kids do better in school.
Yeah, I think it's certainly the case that that study is in dispute, and that people are not sure about its findings. But really, it depends on what record you're listening to, right?
Oh, Christ.
Like, I mean, if you're listening to Bob Dylan, it's going to be very different than if you're, never mind.
Vinyl guys. Ugh.
Sugar Ross.
Than if you're listening to Nevermind. Nick, yeah. Any last takeaway from the Democratic debate before we scratch the needle across the M&M
Ooh,
record?
Good work.
You know, Biden followed up that tour de force over the weekend with an even better monologue, which is widely available, where he talked about corn pop and a showdown with straight razors in the 1950s, stemming from an insult he made as a lifeguard at a municipal swimming pool, where he called somebody who had pomade in his hair but wasn't willing to wear a bathing cap on the high dive, that he called him Esther Williams. And it's just kind of like Biden is at this point is a one-man band for cultural literacy. You listen to him, and like, in order to understand what the fuck he's talking about, you really need to have, you know, a book of trivia or Wikipedia open, which is all to the good. The other thing that, for me, that was interesting coming out of this is that Biden has consistently been tagged as being a white supremacist. And, you know, on woke Twitter, in the wake of the Thursday debate, a bunch of people were calling him a white supremacist. He also gave a talk at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham on Sunday, which was the site of a bombing, a major turning point in the civil rights movement, when four girls were blown up in a bombing of that church. If Biden is, in fact, a white supremacist, it means that Barack Obama was hoodwinked by him, and also the 42% of black voters who, Democratic black voters who have Biden as their top pick, far above Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who are the second and third. You know, there's something bizarre about the discourse coming out of the Democratic debates that is not going to end well for the Democrats, I think. They're really alienating not just white voters by, you know, denouncing everybody as a white supremacist, but apparently even they're going to have to convince plurality of black voters that, you know, Joe Biden, whatever else you say about him, is not actually a white supremacist.
All right, we're going to shift our focus to vaping crackdowns in a moment. But first, I want to share with you all a service being made available to Reason podcast listeners called BetterHelp Online Counseling, or BetterHelp.com. It's an easy, confidential way to hook up with one of 3,000 licensed therapists across all 50 states, tailored specifically to your circumstances and whatever you're facing, whether it's depression, anxiety, trouble sleeping, family hassles, and other trauma. Get help on your own time and on your own preferred communications device, all in less than 24 hours. Super affordable, financial aid is available, and Reason Podcast listeners get 10% off the first month by using the discount code of Reason. Go to betterhelp.com/reason, fill out the questionnaire there so they can set you up with a super personalized professional assistance regime and arrange a secure video or phone session, text, chat, whatever. If you're not happy with your counselor for any reason, you can request a new one whenever you want, no additional charges. Again, that's betterhelp.com/reason. Now, speaking of help, I have plenty of friends, some of them named Michael Moynihan, who have been weaned off the destructive habit of smoking lung darts by using the far less harmful method of vaping flavored nicotine products. And yet the Trump administration last week and the Governor Andrew Cuomo administration in the Fredo Cuomo in New York this week are announcing bans in the name of saving the children. Catherine, can you just explain to the class why this is a demonstration project for every idiot prohibitionist argument ever?
Dear God, it is a demonstration project for every idiot prohibitionist ever. It is astounding how perfectly crafted this is to illustrate that point. Okay, let's review. First of all, some people got sick and died because they vape from a cartridge that was obtained on the black market. It seems pretty clear at this point, though not definitive, that all of the people who were sickened in this wave of vaping related incidents were using THC cartridges to which an adulterant had been added. So the response to this has been to move a whole bunch more popular vaping products into the black market. I want to buy my stuff from giant corporations. That's what I want to buy everything from, but especially drugs. And the idea that we are going to push into the black market or into the gray market a whole bunch of vapes, stuff that Michael Moynihan and others would prefer to use that definitely keeps them off of more dangerous products is a perfect absurdity. And I want to note the Michigan executive order makes it punishable by up to 6 months in prison, the possession of four or more flavored vaping products. You guys, I have four or more flavored vaping products in my house right now, and I don't even vape.
That's just for your kids?
It's for the kids, of course. They like the cotton candy. It's absurd. It's absurd, and it makes me so mad. And I think it's going to happen. I think in New York, it's an emergency now. They're going to do the same thing. Soon it'll be at the federal level. I'm not at all confident that we can stop this, no matter how many angry podcasts we make, and I am deeply disappointed.
Nick, I want you to gut check me. I don't want to be yielding to my 50-something growing amount of pessimism here, but doesn't it kind of feel like there used to be some kind of brakes on the nanny state discussion, right? Like the Democrats were mommy state and Republicans were daddy state, but they would fight the other on those other issues. And that fighting seems to kind of collapse, like, screw it. Let's all ban everything, or let's just be a very paternalistic and maternalistic sort of party and set of policies going forward. Am I being too pessimistic?
Yeah, think you are being too pessimistic.
Thank you. That hurt you to say, didn't it?
Yeah,
it took Nick a little too long to determine that, right? Like, he's like, not certain you're being too pessimistic.
I need more oil. I'm sorry. I'm down a couple quarts.
There, I was like, yeah. The reason why I maternalistic when you're done, Nick, because how come we don't use that word?
Go on.
That's a good word.
Good question. Go on.
I actually, though, I think that, you know, well, this is a side issue, but I think the problem with the idea of the nanny state is that it really genders control over every aspect of our life as something that women are doing. Whereas, like, you know, big nurse to, invoke a character and a controlling metaphor from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. The problem isn't big nurse, it's big doctor, which is, you know, a masculinist enterprise. And that's what's going on here. Note that the people pushing this, or at least the elected officials, you know, whether it's Trump or Andrew Cuomo or men, vaping is a good thing. What is going on now, as Catherine pointed out, is everything is being done to push more and more of it into the shadows, where it just will exacerbate any problems. I have no doubt that at some point vaping will be found, you know, through, you know, extensive medical trials and clinic, you know, all of that kind of stuff, it'll be found to be much safer than smoking tobacco and less safe than not vaping. But let's establish all of that and let's let people go about their business and then inform them of the risks. That's the essence of living in a free society. And Matt, one of the reasons why I'm not super pessimistic about this is that the vaping market has gone from zero to, you know, massive, massive dollars in a relatively short few years, actually. And I think that it's kind of like Uber or Lyft in that sense, that there were attempts by the FDA, including, you know, both by Trump's person, but before him, there were policies put in place to basically, without having any knowledge of the risks of vaping, to say it looks like smoking, so we're banning it everywhere. Smoking is banned, including plane trips, including, you know, restaurants where smoking bans exist. There is now a market for this, and I think those people are going to push back. And I think Americans are kind of fed up with being constantly told what to do by bureaucrats who clearly have no more information than the rest of us.
This is, I mean, Peter, can you? I think the FDA's role here and the culture within the FDA is really important to talk about. This is a classic regulatory bait and switch. The FDA has been increasingly outspoken and concerned about the rise in youth vaping. And this is something that is driven by the public health community, which is just always in a panic about something, as well as driven by annoyed teachers and annoyed parents, because vaping is much easier to hide, say, in school bathrooms than smoking is. And so kids are doing this at school, parents don't like it, teachers don't like it, and the FDA has noticed that, yes, believes that there are more minors vaping. And so what they have done and is use the excuse of adulterated black market marijuana vapes to ban the flavored products that they believe appeal to minors. And so they're trying to, their solution here doesn't even match to the problem that they are supposedly responding to. Instead, it's the solution to a problem that they were trying to solve beforehand but couldn't come up with the political will to do. And it's really a kind of an instructive and revealing move by the public health community, by regulators, to go after something that just isn't the problem. And in fact, in doing so is going to make the problem worse, because when you put all of these products on the black market, you are going to push people into black market products that are much more likely to be adulterated in ways that will make people sick.
Let's go to our end of show. What have you been consuming segment? I am going to invoke moderator's privilege and go first, because last night I was saddened to hear about the death of Cars frontman Rick Ocasek, the great new wave pop rock band, The Cars, and as part of sort of the collective Twitter mourning of this last night, somebody pointed out that their first record, the eponymously record called The Cars, that came out in 1978, which when I was that age was, you'd see it everywhere. The cover, you'll recognize, it is a happy woman with red lipstick behind a gigantic 70 steering wheel. It was literally in absolutely every record store, every warehouse, every licorice pizza back in 1978. Someone pointed out that record itself, which is their debut album, is essentially, would be any other band's greatest hits record. Starts off with Let the Good Times Roll, then My Best Friend's Girl, then Just What I Needed, and it's all You're All I've Got Tonight, all this stuff. It's an amazing record, and I've been listening to it nonstop. Go check it out. I think a lot of people, and I thought this when Tom Petty died as well, underestimate what great, like, pop songwriters some of these new wave post-punk, mid-punk type of artists were. And I would also point out, Rick Ocasek is 4 years younger, or 5 years younger, than my parents. When this came out, he was 34. So shout out to, you know, mid to late career star development. Anyways, super great album. Go listen to it. Pour 40 out for Rick Ocasek.
And Ocasek wasn't just a songwriter. He was a producer. He helped produce, among other things, the first couple of Weezer albums. And one of the reasons those are kind of pop classics is because of his influence, I think.
And Bad Brains, too. Yep. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I regret to inform you all that I have been consuming the Woody Allen movie To Roam With Love. Here's what happened, y'all. So I'm going to go to Rome.
This is a thing that happened to you?
It happened to me. I did it to myself. I'm going to go to Rome in October. And so I was like, I should see some movies about Rome. But I've already seen Roman Holiday. What other movies should I see about Rome? And then Netflix was like, how about this one? Never again, Netflix. I knew better because Woody Allen sucks. But I was like, okay, I'm going to give it a try. Some things you need to know about this movie. First of all, it was entirely paid for by Rome. This movie itself is a document that is like the perfect proof of why like municipal film subsidies are bad and produce bad art and are bad, because this is a bad movie. Also, starring Ellen Page as a, you know, mostly heterosexual femme fatale in a really deep look at how Woody Allen understands the psyches of women. And I want you to know from the Wikipedia entry that the cascade of names that this film was going to have, which I think captures the sort of stink of resignation on the whole thing. He was initially going to call it Bop Decameron. And then when everyone was like, we don't know what that is anymore because people don't read books, he was like, okay, we'll call it Nero Fiddles. And then, first of all, I think we could actually all be grateful it's not called that in the wake of subsequent events. But so then people were still confused. And so then he was like, fine, screw it. It's called To Rome With Love. Just give me my money.
I should have renamed it Corn Pop
Corn
and the Romans.
Corn Pop and the Straight Razor is what it should have become. Yeah. Don't see this movie, guys. If you have, my condolences to you. If you haven't, this is purely a public service announcement. What a piece of garbage.
Are there any Woody Allen films that you like? Have you seen Deconstructing Harry, Manhattan, Annie Hall?
I will absolutely watch. I will rewatch an Annie Hall. What's the musical one where he hits his head and becomes Republican? That's good too. Like, there are some good Woody Allen movies, but like late stage Woody Allen makes me upset and depressed. Also, there's always a speech now in the Woody Allen movies, and maybe there always was, but it was just delivered more artfully, where like the Woody Allen stand-in says about the lady character, sure, she sounds like she knows a lot of things, but isn't she really just, you know, posturing for the crowd? And I've always wondered, like, does he know that that's really about him or not? Anyway, horrible.
My advice for artistic audiovisual Rome prep is one of Anthony Bourdain's last bits of Rome. It's where he met what's-her-face that became his girlfriend. And you could and it's
Asia Argento.
Yes. And it's just incredibly beautifully shot. Really, it's a piece of art, and you also see him, and it's tragic to watch it now, falling in love with her. Nick, what have you been consuming?
Well, I just, if you want more Rome movies, Catherine, I would recommend Rossellini's Open City, as well as Fellini's La Dolce Vita, which is also a cautionary tale about journalism. Either of those is great.
Thank you. Does I should have asked you guys first, instead of just taking Netflix's word for it.
Is there any theatrical taking off of glasses, Nick, in La Dolce Vita?
It's, you know, there's a reason why Mastroianni is wearing glasses, and it's not to keep them on, Matt. But to follow up on the idea of death inspiring a review of somebody's career, Robert Frank, the great Swiss-born photographer and documentarian, died about a week ago at age 94. And he is well known for a book that came out in 1958 called The Americans, where he toured the country and took these stunning pictures of people around the country in all sorts of poses and whatnot. It's fantastic. And then he is probably best known. The stuff that I watched with special care was also in 1958, I guess, a document or a film that he made with Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and a bunch of other of the Beats called Pull My Daisy, which was it's available on YouTube, a real major document of kind of the Beat generation, but more importantly, kind of one of those places where stuff was introduced to America that really shook things up and just kind of opened up possibilities. Later, he also did the artwork for Exile on Main Street, the Rolling Stones record, which was was put together from a bunch of photos that he had done. And then they commissioned him to do a documentary, a behind-the-scenes documentary of their 1972 American tour, which he did do. It was called Cocksucker Blues. It is a phenomenal documentary about rock. And it portrayed the Rolling Stones in such a negative light, or in such a caustic light, that they actually sued to keep the movie from being shown and were largely successful in the they claim that they own the rights to the film because they had merely hired him. It shows the Stones offstage and their entourage shooting up, having sex, being bored beyond belief, and being boring beyond belief. Keith Richards was at the peak, or at one peak of his heroin addiction. And then what is great is that that's counterposed with fantastic footage of the Stones on stage when they were arguably at their peak as the world's greatest rock and roll band. As a result of lawsuits, the movie for many years could only be shown up to four or five times a year at film festivals if Robert Frank was present. It also is available on YouTube, at least for a while. You will watch this documentary if you like the Rolling Stones, if you like documentary filmmaking, if you like a kind of pulling back of the veil of manufactured image versus reality. It is a movie that is instantly recognizable, because even though it was not allowed to be shown, definitely informed its sensibility, informed almost every film and almost every documentary that came after it. Really fantastic. So Robert Frank, who also has a great quote of saying, "I was passionate about losers." And that comes through in all of his work. Just a really major talent who's worth looking at.
Kurt Loder has a good review of that back in the Reason archives. I'll throw up a link on the post on this podcast. Peter Suderman, what have you been consuming?
I saw It Chapter 2. Like the Democratic debate, it is an ensemble piece with a kind of underwhelming cast. Like the Democratic debate, it was nearly 3 hours long, and like the Democratic debate, it was awful. I didn't love the first one, but there were some things about it that were pretty charming and appealing. In particular, the cast of young actors. The first one, it's based on Stephen King's 1980s novel, which is like 17,000 pages long and takes place in two time periods with characters who are both children and adults. And so for the movies, what they did was they split the stories. The first one was about the kids. The second one was mostly about the adults. The kids just make cameo appearances. And the child actors are really pretty great, and it turns into a kind of an interesting coming-of-age story that also has some really kind of ineffective, very loud Dolby Jolt scares. And so when it's not trying to scare you, the first one is an okay movie. The third one is a rehash with adult actors that's a half an hour longer and much more focused on just bludgeoning you with extremely loud noises. Catherine, you'd love it, is what I'm saying.
I stopped listening a while ago.
It's not in any way frightening or scary, because in particular, the second act, the sort of the bulk of the movie, the middle portion of it, the characters split up, and then each of them goes and finds like a relic from their childhood that it actually has no meaning and doesn't sort of really play much role in the plot, but it's like something that's supposed to be symbolically important to them. And then as they do, some weird stuff starts to happen, and then the weird stuff turns into an extremely large and very loud CGI monster that is just pounding you through the speakers, and it's like that for 3 hours, and I wanted to go watch Joe Biden talk about record players. That's all I wanted.
I'm going to scold you for not making a clown analogy to the Democratic debate. Why are we even here? Why are we even here?
I mean, there was a scary clown in both. There you go.
Redeemed.
Thank you for that addendum. That's all the time we have here. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Keep listening throughout the week to Reason Podcasts, and leave comments and encouragements, suggestions as well, wherever that is available. Thanks, and catch you next week.